Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I'm here today with colleagues and guests to talk about the role of civil society in skills development. The European Commission has dedicated 2023 as its European Year of Skills, with the idea of giving fresh momentum to lifelong learning and helping people and companies contribute to the green and digital transitions. In this special skills series, we discuss how we can use upskilling and reskilling initiatives to help vulnerable groups in the workplace, how to build a resilient workforce, and how to help the EU labor market function better. I am joined today by Duygu Güner, an affiliate fellow here at Bruegel and the head of our Future of Work program. Also, Rafaela Kier, who is Deputy Secretary General and Head of Policy at the European Association for the Education of Adults, and Serta Cierikaya, who is Country Manager of a nonprofit coding school in Turkey. She's joining us from Istanbul today. Thank you all for coming. Duygu, can you tell us a little bit about where we stand and what we are trying to achieve with the current set of projects?
Hi, Rebecca. Thank you for having us in this conversation. And also thank you, Sertaç and Rafaela, for joining us. So actually, the last few months, we have been spending a lot of effort to understand better the skill landscape in the EU labor market, the needs and how we are currently trying to tackle the unmet skills demand in the labor market. And it eventually landed on the involvement of civil society, because although the European labor markets have been done rather quickly to recover from the negative impact of the COVID crisis, but also now with the energy price shock, I think we had a great recovery. And now the employment rate is all-time high at 74.6%. But still, we have enduring problems. And the long-term target for the European Commission is to increase the employment rate even further to 80% by 2030.
This is 80% of all adults in Europe?
Yes, exactly. This is the target. And actually, it means 10 million more employment, while every year, 1 million of working force leaves the labor market because of aging. They just transition to retirement. This 10 million is a really very high target. It is not that easy to achieve. But then there are other systematic problems in the labor market. So the need for increasing employment is one, but there are also currently a very high rate of vacancies which employers are not able to fulfill. So the job vacancy rate is currently at 2.93% in EU. This might look like a low number compared to the levels in US. If we consider the evolution in the EU labor market over the last few years, we see that it is the highest level. And if you zoom in the specific industries, you see that in manufacturing, this rate is tripled in the last 10 years. For service, it is slightly better, but it is doubled. So, of course, the reason we are seeing this very high job vacancy rate is because employers are not able to find people who have the skills they require for given occupations. So this skill gap is hindering many things in society, but it is also hindering the twin transition. We see that companies are not able to adopt new technologies just because they don't have the human capital to implement, adopt these technologies. So if we are really serious about reaching the long-term targets of the EU, we have to address this skills gap in the labor market. And currently, the way we do is mostly relies on employers. They are the main funders of the reskilling, upskilling projects. But then it is not working. We see the people who are most in need of reskilling, they don't really have access to these training opportunities. And what we are doing now is not really serving our needs. So we are hoping to advocate for the better involvement, more involvement of civil society, and I hopefully close the gap in the nearer future.
So, Rafaela, you are with an association that presumably is part of civil society. As you tell us how your group is working on this, I would also appreciate it if you could define civil society for us. Is it mostly groups like yours? Is it other types of groups? Who are we talking about? And how are you all contributing?
That's a good question. I think there's several different definitions of civil society. How we see it is that we really bring together grassroots organizations, but also their national, regional associations. And then, of course, as a European association, we work together a lot with international and European associations that also represent civil society. So for us, it's always about going to the grassroots, finding out what citizens and people need, which kinds of services, which kinds of other provision support they need. And this is basically what civil society does. So just really to represent the interests of citizens.
Tell us how your group is working to meet some of these gaps that we've identified and what things you think would help for those of us who are new to the topic in getting our heads around the issue.
We try to identify which initiatives there are at the grassroots level to bring together different partners, and that can be civil society together with academia, for instance, but it can also be partnerships with municipalities, local authorities, the private sector even. So you can think of a very broad range of different partnership types of cooperation at the various levels of decision making, of learning provision. And I think this is where we also see the biggest impact when you try to reach out to those who are furthest away from learning. So our interest is not only to focus on those people who already are in the labor market and perhaps have possibilities to participate in employment-related learning, but especially those people who are away from this, removed from learning due to their background. Some of them might be migrants. Some of them might be long-term unemployed. Some of them might have disabilities. There are many people who actually face a lot of barriers when it comes to participation in learning. And I think what civil society really does very well is to use these partnerships to reach out to these groups of learners and then bring them in, create motivation, also show to people that they are able to learn, because you must imagine that a lot of people don't believe in themselves, especially if they have negative experience with prior learning, then they might also be hesitant to participate in further education, in lifelong learning. So what these partnerships then do is to show to people that they have already a lot of skills, and that they can build on these skills, and that they are able to learn, and that learning is something that's really bringing joy to them. And it's not only something that they need perhaps for a specific job or something, but that it's also really something for themselves, for their personal development, but also to be able to participate fully in society.
So Sertaj, what kind of students do you have at your academy, and how do they feel coming in and going out?
Actually, I feel more advantages compared to other side, because I'm working on the supply side and I have so many young people getting prepared for technology jobs. The association I'm working, there are the candidates for software development over 18 years old. This is a 42 school. It's the French-based school. The philosophy is very different than the schools that we are having currently. It is the first computing programming school that is entirely free and available for the students with or without degrees. There is no requirement. Just being 18 years old, the only requirement to apply the school. So it has a new teaching method. There is no teachers. There is no lectures. That's all full hands-on learning from applying, learning from project-based examples, and based on peer learning as well. So that makes students more free to learn the technical skills and also develop their soft skills like resilience, like collaboration, like team working. They learn the basics of software. They learn C as a language. They don't learn the emerging languages. But the soft skills they are developing, they can easily adapt to new languages if needed. So it is very competitive for the job environment.
They can easily learn, they can easily adapt the challenges they have in their businesses.
Are you mostly working with young people, or do you get people at all stages of their careers who want to come and learn these skills?
As Turkey has a very young population, our median age 32, I'm mostly working with young people, but we have also students from older ages like 50 plus. Or we have also students like want to change their career. They are already doctors or lawyers or engineers in different areas or audiologists. They want to change their career as into a software engineering. So they are also our students. But mostly I'm working with young people.
That's fascinating.
Actually, young people, they have more choices to join. They have more activities to have. And mostly they are university students. Also, they are continuing their universities. The students over 28 or 30, they are fast learners because they have a dedication to complete the course and to get a new job and to start to earn.
I think this connects very nicely with what Rafaela just said and what Sertac is mentioning about the age profile of the learner. So one of the reasons that we see the young people having reaching more for opportunities compared to old generation is actually has a lot to do with what Rafaela just said about believing they have opportunities or previous learning experiences. Once you have at a certain point in your career, especially this is true for mid-career workers, because we also see that they are facing ageism in recruitment processes. People don't really acknowledge that they have the opportunity to learn and to grow, to change careers, to shift. Sometimes the opportunity cost is too high because they have responsibilities. They don't have the time, the finances to invest, to stop working, to train. So there are many things behind that. But I think a very important part of it is also coming from people not believing they have something to gain in these trainings. So what we see when we check the training participation patterns, we see that people who actually need the most, they are not participating. And the main claim is people never really acknowledge that they don't believe they have the opportunity. They always say they don't need to participate. They don't want to participate. So this is, I think, a cover story. And I think we need to dig it a bit deeper to really learn what is the actual barriers in terms of training. And for that, what we do at a more EU level is not really very successful. We cannot really dig deeper and catch this regional, local, cultural disparities. But for that, I think, again, civil society plays a key role to identify these nuanced barriers and to bring it to the policy agenda, because they are also great advocates for people who are coming from disadvantaged groups.
Rafaela, how do you balance the eager people who are looking to change their careers and very much need the skills and opportunities that these training presents with those who either see barriers or are not optimistic they can make the changes or otherwise are not interested? How do we navigate that?
Perhaps I can bring in a critical perspective on adult learning and education, because I've actually seen that now over the last few weeks and months quite a lot in media, in newspapers, and so on, that authors are actually quite critical of this dogma of lifelong learning. So there's this perception that you are forced to constantly upskill, reskill, that you can never be too sure of your employment. So you always need to work on your skills. Otherwise, you will lose your job or you will not be able to move into any other sector. So this can actually also then create a barrier to participation, because then it creates this resistance. And this is something that we as civil society actually want to counteract, in the sense that we want to show the joy of learning, that learning isn't something that is just a necessity or something that needs to be done, but that there are so many things that you can learn that are really fun. And this depends then, of course, very much on the methodologies. I think civil society is very innovative in terms of creating new methodologies, new learning contents. So this is already helping quite a bit. But then I think we also need to see the whole spectrum of non-formal adult learning that is there, that brings people into learning that are not necessarily interested in employment-related learning, but then discover that actually, I'm doing this sewing class and my adult education center also offers these other classes. Why not just go to these classes as well? So people gradually move from one class, a type of a learning program, to another, and discover for themselves that learning is something that brings joy to their lives, that also includes them socially, because they get in touch with new types of people, new groups of people. Perhaps I can also share my own experience as a very passionate adult learner. I go to sewing classes, and there we are women between the age of 25 and 75. And it's just so much fun meeting those people that I would otherwise never meet in my normal work life and so on, because they just are in different walks of life. And I think this is what a lot of people feel about non-formal adult education. So we really want to bring in this other perspective of lifelong learning that's not only that necessity and dogma, but something that is enriching life, that brings life skills, that enables people to think critically, to work on sustainability, green skills. Also develop, democracy skills, work on peace education. All of these kinds of skills are so important right now, but they are not very visible, because all we focus on is the labor market. But then we don't see that these skills are actually also very much important for the labor market, but not directly as, you know, vocational education and training, but as skills that everyone needs to be fully a part of society and of their own communities.
You raise a great point about skills to be learned for the sake of learning skills versus skills that directly contribute to economic need. When we come back, we'll talk more about this and also how different parts of society can come together to fund this and make it happen. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. We were just talking about skills and learning and how sometimes it makes sense for people to learn things because they want to learn them and it makes them a better and more fulfilled version of themselves. And sometimes they want to learn things because they want to earn money and improve their economic situation. And this doesn't even account for all the times when employers want people to learn things that they might not think about learning on their own because they want to have workers with those skills. Daigo, how do we balance all of that? And what should we be thinking about in trying to facilitate these things?
I also want to add what Rafaela said, joy of learning, and why it is important. Even though it might not be necessarily a work-related skill, it is still very relevant for the labor markets, because as technology is changing drastically, the jobs, the tasks, the skills needed to perform those tasks, they are changing so fast. And most of the time, we don't even have an idea what is going to be the skills in demand in the next few years. I'm not talking about next few decades or a big revolution, but really like in the next few years, we don't know. We have some ideas, we have some estimates, but we don't really know what we will be really demanded in the labor market. One thing we know for sure is that we need to have this learning culture embedded in our societies, so that whatever the need be, whatever the evolution takes us, wherever it takes us, the people should have this internal motivation to evolve accordingly. They should be able to acknowledge the change and adapt themselves without an external motivation, without an external enabler. So in that sense, to know the joy of learning, to have it internalized, is, I think, the most important thing we need to create. This is why now currently there is emphasis also going beyond the working age, and some civil organizations are targeting people at primary schools, like the children, the kids, even with preschool age, so that they have this internal making learning fun and making learning something internally defining them, which we will benefit in the next two decades. So currently the problem is so urgent that we are focusing mostly on the labor markets. But this is a persistent problem. It's not going to change. It's not going to go away. So the efforts also should be stretched beyond the borders of the labor market to non-forms of learning. Some hobbies is also relevant.
Sertaj, does your program allow you to bring hobbyists in as well as the people who are really focused on getting good jobs?
Of course, it is a self-learning program as there is no teacher and there is no lectures. All the students are learning according to their pace. So they have lots of opportunity to improve their soft skills as well. They are meeting with CTOs. They are having lectures on fintech or gaming or machinery equipment development. Many other topics are already included parallel to the main curriculum. So there are lots of opportunities for them to understand what is the real working environment is, what is expected from them when they start working. Unfortunately, after COVID and after the digital transformation, let's say, they don't have chance to work in an office environment. So it is very difficult for them to get into the cultural change or feel part of a team with the physical presence. But having those kind of seminars, those kind of get-togethers also helps them to feel what the real working environment is. And I would like to add some comments on this skill part, what Duygu was mentioning, Mayor. I think that the definition of skill is, there's a problem on the understanding and definition of skills among the stakeholders. There are so many reports about skills and gaps, but there is not a common understanding. There is not a common skill taxonomy that we all agree on. For example, according to World Economic Forum, the Future of Work report, it says that 1/4 of the jobs today will be disrupted in 5 years. And 44% of the fundamental skills have to be gone under transformation. So with having like 3.4 billion workforce in the world, we had a lot of responsibility to do to change this transformation on top of our jobs. And it is, as Rafaela and Duygu said, that technical skills are not easy to define. For example, previously, manual dexterity was said that will diminish, but after COVID, it is now at top 10 skills expected for the future workforce. Or AI and data, when we consider AI and data as skill, it is very difficult to obtain that skill and to develop AI tools. So we need a few people maybe very good at AI tool development. So there is no need for panic. But if we are talking about information and data literacy, everybody has to be literate about reading data. So we have to be panicked then considering the workforce all around the world. So there is a need to define and to have the same language on the skills in order to address the real gaps, address the actions and address the policies required to cover these needs.
Can you tell us more about your funding, the mix of nonprofits, corporate funding, government funding, other ways? Who's providing the funds for this and what are they looking to see? Are there particular metrics? Is it just that you provide the classes? How does all that fit together?
It is a publicly funded program. There are also private companies sponsoring the program. Because at the end of the day, they will be the user or the employer of these skills we are developing. They are also part of the program. There is no responsibility on the student side. It's a whole free of charge. And there is no obligations on the student side. They are all free. Funders, let's say public funding, the measurement is increasing the number of people because we have a target of reaching so many software developers in the country. So it is contributing to that target. So measurement is increasing the number of software developers in the country. From the private company side, they are looking for software developers. Universities are not good enough to provide the necessary skills in the number and in the proficiency side. So they are asking for new skilled and competitive software developers.
That's really interesting. It shows that we're looking at corporate interests as well as what they sometimes call corporate responsibility, which tends to be framed as companies giving back. What you're talking about sounds like corporate investment, where they're really trying to make things happen that will work for them. Rafaela, how do you see this balance coming through in terms of private sector funding?
We know from the data that we have that private sector funding for adult learning and education is actually really very important. It's in many countries six times as much as the public funding for adult learning and education, which is really a substantial difference. We can also see, unfortunately, that there is a stagnant or even reduced public funding for adult learning nowadays, and especially also in the countries that are traditionally those that are most supportive of public adult learning programs. For instance, in the Nordic countries that have now seen changes in their governments that have an impact on the actual funding of these programs, which also makes the private funding, of course, all the more important. But then we always need to be a bit careful with the potential impact of private funding on the providers, because very often it comes with certain conditions. For instance, we've seen that with the big tech companies that provide laptops or software to providers, that then these providers really need to stay with these companies. So they can't just say, okay, now we have this type of computer system, but we would like to use another one because it would be more beneficial for our learners. This is then generally not possible, because then you're attached to the funding, of course, so you can't just move freely. Having said that, it still opens up a lot of opportunities that wouldn't exist if we only had the public funding. From our side, as a European association, of course, we would like to see a substantial increase of public funding. And this is something that the EU and member states have committed to in the Marrakesh Framework for Action of the United Nations that was adopted last year. We have recently done a review of what has been done ever since in EU member states, and we don't actually see any increase of funding, but rather the opposite. So there's that. What also plays a huge role in many countries is the participants' funding. So not all programs, as those that Sertac has described, are completely free for the learners, but very often learners actually have to pay participation fees. And this is also a type of funding that's very important. And then another funding stream is European funding that is increasingly becoming important in quite a lot of member states, where we actually see a shift from the national or regional funding for adult learning to European funding. So in a way, of course, it helps to build new structures, to innovate, to become a bit more creative in terms of methodologies, learning content, and so on. But on the other hand, it also just really means that then for national or regional governments, it can mean, oh, okay, now fine, you are funding this, so we don't have to do it anymore. And then we have an issue if we really want to increase the participation in adult learning to 60% until 2030. This is one of the EU benchmarks, and we are very far away from this. So let's see what the countries will do to really increase participation levels.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll talk about advocacy and ways to make sure everyone is included in this process. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Durgo, how do we make sure that everyone who needs to be included is part of these programs? And what is the role of advocacy in this system?
So maybe before that, I want to remind everyone, our listeners as well, that the first principle of the European Pillars of Social Right is to ensure that everyone has the right to good education and training throughout their whole life. So this is one of the principles we are trying to achieve at the EU level. So it's not just a good to have. It is one of our main targets for the EU. So there, as Rafaela mentioned, the existence of public funds are really important because these funds are enabling lower level organizations at a more disaggregated level to really tailor the needs of different groups of the society. When the funding is more strict and depends on success measures are more tied to paid employment, all these people who are really not the best candidates, they fall in the cracks. So, but when you have public funding, then civil society organizations are more able to take what they call as a positive outcome. So for some people, it could be leaving the house. So before coming to paid work, there are many steps that a marginalized person might need to take. And I think civil society is great addressing in that. And for that, they need public fundings.
That is a great way of pointing out all the different ways that people can have trouble accessing some of this learning and some of these opportunities. So, Tatcha, I'd like to ask you, because you're outside the EU, do you find that people who go through your program have an easier time working with international companies? Does it facilitate integration, which is something that in the long run, the EU and Turkey are hoping to work toward?
The technology companies are multinational, so the technology language is very common to integrate with. And there are also for English, especially the main language of the business. So most English is a barrier to enter the multinational environment, but with the technology supporting the fast learning or the like ChatGPT, the tools to translate easily, it helps also people to work for multinationals. Is it good or is it bad? We can discuss, because from the university times, they start working from China to US in a daytime. So they may stop their education, especially the talented ones. From the second year of the university, they start working for all over the world from the country. And it is affecting their education as well. So it is another angle we can discuss later.
Rafaela, tell us how to find this balance.
I would like to connect to something that Duygu mentioned about how civil society helps to build partnerships, because there are really great examples of, for instance, how civil society works together with social housing, women's initiatives, especially in rural areas, libraries and other kinds of services, where it's really at a very local level that initiatives, associations get together, see a bit where there are needs for reaching out to new groups of learners, who is probably very much excluded from learning and why. So identify the issues that might be there, and then really bring people together, ensure also through guidance services, for instance, that people can smoothly move into learning between the different types of learning, also from non-formal to more formal vocational education and training. This can be really beneficial for communities, but of course also the learners themselves.
Thank you. This has been a really great discussion. As we close out this episode of The Sound of Economics, I'd like to hear from each of our guests, what is the one thing that you wish could happen going forward in terms of EU action or collaborative partnerships? What's your number one wish list for the thing you'd like to see? Duygu?
Inclusion. My biggest fear is that the digital transformation mostly, but also green transition to some extent, is just going to exaggerate the inequalities in the labor market, because the opportunity is not equally distributed. The access is not equal. And my biggest fear is that although it could have a converging effect in well-being across EU, it might create a bigger gap between different socioeconomic groups. So my wish is that we find the good policies where we can use this transformation to our advantage and close the gaps in the society.
Sertac?
We are discussing this problem from the corporation side. I wish we start to discuss the same topic from the individual side, because most of although researches show that there is a lack of skills for the labor market, the researches also shows that There is a high salary demand that corporations doesn't want to pay for, or there is dissatisfaction with the working environment, so young people or the people doesn't want to prefer to work there. They don't want to work in shifts. They don't want to work in hazardous nature of the job. So I wish we start discussing what as individuals we need from the work, because as far as I see from the young people that I'm working with, they are not seeing the work as a place they earn money for their life. They see the working environment as a lifestyle. So if this satisfies their envisioned life for the future, they prefer to work without discussing the level of money they will be earning, but they have to feel that the work will be their dreams, their way of working, their way of living. I wish we start discussing this one as well, so we make the corporations to change the business models they are offering to us.
Thank you for that, Rafael.
I'd like to echo what Tüge and Sertac said. I think we really need to start looking at the needs of all learners, potential learners as well, and create learner-centered policies, because then they will be really effective and efficient.
So inclusion, workers' benefits, and conditions to help people learn so that they can feel included and have a chance to go looking for those good jobs. I love it. Duigo, are there any final thoughts you'd like to offer on the role of civil society and what people should be looking for as we close out this year of skills?
So maybe also quickly that we didn't mention at all, but I think it is a big part of what civil society can do for us, is to bring together different stakeholders. I know Sertaj does it already, Rafael also. This is a very beneficial working model. And also civil society can be monitoring the effectiveness and the impact of skill development programs. I think civil society is a great impartial observer and critic of these initiatives.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you, listeners, for coming back to The Sound of Economics. You can find our work from the Future of Work program and other Bruegel initiatives at Bruegel.org. And you can find this podcast and all of its archives and future episodes on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks again. See you next time.